Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Today's episode is brought to you by Plexaderm, and it seems like we have a two-front war. The Turks are invading Syria, taking the president both literally and seriously when he gave them the green light to attack the Kurds. And then, of course, we have the White House message to Congress drop dead, declaring war against the congressional impeachment inquiry. Joining us to discuss all of this today is our friend James Homan from The Washington Post, the author and editor of The Daily 202. Thanks for joining me. I appreciate it very much.
Good to be with you, Charlie.
I'm guessing that the newsletter is hot off the presses even as we speak.
There's just so much news. It's so hard to keep up on everything. Even every single one of those stories, you know, there's 50 developments, and it can be easy to lose sight of kind of what the bigger story is.
Well, yes, and as we were talking about before the podcast, these daily newsletters are a harsh mistress because, I mean, as soon as you get them done, something else happens in the news cycle. So I want to start off with, obviously, we're going to get to what's happening in the Middle East in a moment. But let's talk about the president defying impeachment and the escalation of this fight. This is your lead on the newsletter today. So let's talk about where we are at. The president not only is telling Congress basically drop dead, but this seems to be part of a pattern with this president, who has shown sort of a proclivity to, you know, declare vast authorities for his office and immunities from the rule of law. So this is really part of that, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. The line that President Trump has uttered like 10 times in the last 3 months, Charlie, is Article 2 allows me to do whatever I want. Obviously, Article 2 enumerates a lot of specific powers for the president, but by no means gives him total power. It's also the article that outlines what impeachment should look like. Yesterday was interesting because everyone focused on the Pat Cipollone letter, the letter from the White House counsel, which was basically like, we're not going to cooperate at all. We're not going to respond to document requests. We're not going to let witnesses testify. But there were actually a couple other developments, too, that get to that point that you just made, which is that this is part of a pattern. There was a hearing in the D.C. District Court yesterday related to an effort by the House Judiciary Committee to get some of the grand jury materials that Bob Mueller relied on to prepare his report. And the Congress is trying to get them as part of its investigations. This started before the Ukraine scandal really blew up. But something interesting happened during the two-hour hearing, which was that a lawyer for the Justice Department announced in court that their new position is that the court erred in 1974 by allowing Congress to review materials, Watergate grand jury. And it was a really striking hearing because Beryl Howell, the chief judge for the district court in D.C., literally said, wow, and repeated herself. Wow, I can't believe that's the government's position is that this landmark case from 45 years ago was wrongly decided. And the Justice Department lawyer said, yes, that we think it was an ambiguous interpretation of law. She said that's a totally extreme argument, made clear she's not going to accept it. But what's amazing is that wasn't actually the Trump administration's most brazen claim of executive power that day. You know, the Gordon Sondland being blocked from testifying, right. Rudy Giuliani announced that he's not going to respond to the House subpoena for documents in his testimony. He tweeted, let them hold me in contempt. It's not just one letter or one thing. This is their mentality. I think it's as much a political strategy as a legal one. I think that, you know, there's not kind of strong constitutional arguments for not complying at all in any way with oversight and kind of the basic checks and balances. But I think Trump's made a calculation. He'd much rather be talking about process and document production and that kind of a thing than kind of discussing the underlying charges from the whistleblower and what we've seen in the transcript about his conduct toward Ukraine.
But it is extraordinary the kinds of powers that he's claiming. You know, you mentioned those two court cases, but also we had that federal judge earlier in the week, you know, rejecting the arguments that he was essentially above the law. And this involved the New York DA trying to get his tax documents. And just I'm going to read this one account here, you know, from the 75-page ruling that, you know, Trump's arguments went, you know, a step further, starting with a general claim the Constitution gave him sweeping immunity, not just from indictment and prosecution, but also from any investigation by federal or state authorities. And the judge really very pointedly noted that, you know, when we threw off the British crown, the founders dismissed that notion. And this is what he wrote in this opinion. Shunning the concept of the inviolability of the person of the King of England and the bounds of the monarch's protective screen, the founders disclaimed any notion that the Constitution generally conferred similarly all-encompassing immunity upon the president. Now, yeah, that's pretty clear, but you can almost sense in all of that language the same sort of reaction you just described from the judge in D.C. Like, are you kidding me?
What?
Are you really standing in front of me arguing that? Because basically what he's saying is the president cannot be indicted. He cannot be investigated by state or, federal authorities. And now basically saying he's challenging the legitimacy of the one check on presidential power that the Constitution has, which is the power of impeachment.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. What's also funny is the Trump lawyers have been trying to kind of have it both ways when it comes to these court filings. And that's one of the things that the judge observed in that 75-page ruling, which is that when the prosecutors, when a New York district attorney is trying to get the tax returns, they say, no, that's not, that's only the province of Congress. Only Congress can do that. And then when Congress tries to get the tax returns, the lawyers say, no, only prosecutors can get that. There's not a compelling legislative interest in getting that. And so it is very situational what the Trump team's position is on who should have access to what.
Yeah, this whole idea that we don't have a king, though, is interesting to me, because you have, some of the camp followers of the president, like Attorney Joe Geneva, who went on, I assume, Fox News, saying that this was regicide, which is the perfect description, right? I mean, perfect description of what's happening, except we don't have a king and nobody's being killed. But other than that, it is regicide. So you talked about this letter from, how do you even start this? The letter from the White House counsel, refusing to participate. This is an 8-page letter. I saw somebody tweeting. I wish I knew who he was. His name is Brad Simpson. He said the White House letter announcing that Trump won't cooperate with the impeachment inquiry reads like it was drafted by Rudy Giuliani, Stephen Miller, and Sean Hannity after snorting a bunch of coke, reading an Ann Coulter book, watching a Dinesh D'Souza talk, and sniffing glue. Which I want to go on the record as saying is probably slightly overstating it.
Well, and I was struck by how many people kind of, not just the usual suspects, but how many movement conservatives who have kind of made peace with Trump were like, the guy Greg Nunziata, who was a longtime general counsel for Marco Rubio, worked for John Thune. He was the chief nominations counsel for the Republicans on the Senate Judiciary Committee. He said, quote, "This letter is bananas. It's a barely lawyered temper tantrum, a middle finger to Congress and its oversight responsibilities. Things are bad. Things will get worse." It would just striking thing for someone like him to say.
It is striking. But, this really goes back to, whether or not Republicans are going to be okay with all of this. And your newsletter this morning does talk to a number of Republican lawyers, conservative lawyers. What are they telling you? What are they saying about this?
I think that they right now there's no indication that kind of the stonewalling is impacting Republican support on the Hill. Like you're not one of the things that's interesting is that the letter that we're talking about from the White House counsel, an earlier draft of that letter said that the White House wouldn't comply unless Congress voted to formally open an impeachment inquiry. And they dropped that from the letter. And there's some speculation, including among Trump insiders, as to why they did that. There was some pushback. There are some House Republicans who don't want to have to go on the record saying, no, we shouldn't look into this. And I think there was also some concern in the White House that if they said they weren't going to cooperate unless the House voted to open an impeachment inquiry, Nancy Pelosi could totally call their bluff, have a vote, have it pass. And then, it would be harder for them, not that they wouldn't, but to justify not cooperating at all. It is interesting because those are debates that are going on. And I think that to your question, they're doing a lot to think about how they can push the envelope as far as they can on executive power and on stonewalling, while at the same time not doing things that are going to prompt, moderate Republicans or principled conservatives to say this is crazy. I'm not going to go along with this or to speak out against the president.
Well, and as you point out, though, the one of the aspects of this is under Bill Barr, the Justice Department has really increasingly intervened on Trump's behalf, including when he sues other people. Trump famously, asked, "Where's my Roy Cohn?" He's gotten his Roy Cohn, but it is sort of eyebrow raising to watch how the Justice Department has really become an extension of this sort of Trumpian legal political id.
It's shocking, and I talked to a lot of people in the Justice Department who were incredibly uncomfortable with it, career folks and otherwise, I think in retrospect, it's not really surprising if you look at Barr's record. He spent 40 years kind of advocating for an expansion of executive power, and that's sort of what he's doing across the board. But it's something for the Justice Department. Remember, as you know, and listeners know, the Justice Department isn't supposed to be the president's lawyer. It's supposed to be the people's lawyer. And I think that they've objectively crossed that line to care more about sort of the president's political and personal interests, including on something like the Emoluments Clause, than what's in the public interest.
Well, going back to all of this, and you point out this is at least as political as it is legal in terms of its strategy, and the pressure is on Nancy Pelosi to hold a formal impeachment vote because they want to talk about that process, and this seems to be the talking point that until there's a formal impeachment vote, then this is somehow not legitimate. So I guess the question is, why not? Why has Nancy Pelosi not called their bluff on this and just called a vote?
Yeah, I think that there is some hesitancy in the Pelosi operation to have some of their Democrats vote for it, just because they fear that there would that it's sort of in the overly simplified world of kind of local TV news and political campaign commercials. There would be X member voted for impeachment. And I think, there would be a handful, maybe up to a dozen Democrats who would not want to vote for the impeachment inquiry. And I think Pelosi wants to avoid a story about Democratic holdouts and anything that sort of makes the caucus look like it's not united. And she doesn't feel like she has to do it. Her lawyers have told her that she doesn't have to do it. But so I think that there's those considerations and tensions. I do think there's one school of thought among some House Democrats I've been talking to that this Trump maneuver is going to kind of short circuit the process. I think the White House believes they're dragging the process out, that this is going to play into 2020. These are going to, the saying we're not going to cooperate is going to lead to more court fights, that, the wheels of justice grind very slowly. I think that there is some scenario where Democrats just say, look, if you're going to obstruct the inquiry, we're just going to kind of move quickly past some kind of impeachment and then move on, which is still in a lot of ways, I think, what Nancy Pelosi wants to do. I think a lot of members want to be talking about pocketbook issues. So I don't know if that helps the president, because it does prevent Democrats and the investigators in the House from getting to the bottom of what happened and how involved he was. But there is a chance that it sort of makes the impeachment train move actually faster rather than slower, as the president thinks.
Which raises the question about whether or not they do have a coherent, coordinated strategy. As you note this morning, the Trump loyalists in the House were blindsided by the blocking of Ambassador Sondland from testifying.
Yeah, some State Department lawyer left a voicemail for Sondland's lawyer at 12:30 in the morning yesterday on Tuesday and said, your client can't testify. He had flown from Brussels. He was ready to testify. Republicans were ready to question him. And so there was frustration on the Hill among kind of the Jim Jordans of the world, the hardcore Trump loyalists, who were upset at the White House for not coordinating with them first. Basically, their messages were carrying water for you up here, like, you need to help us out. And so that's why you had the video, where the guy from Florida, Matt Gaetz, is talking about Captain Kangaroo and, you know, it felt very hasty. And that was because the message wasn't really planned. It did. Yes. Improvised is the right word.
Okay. Does Matt Gaetz really think that Kangaroo Court comes from Captain Kangaroo, or that Captain Kangaroo is somehow related to Kangaroo Court? I mean, does he really think that?
I don't know.
Who knows?
It is funny because a lot of people, you know, who knows is right. You know, the Post did like a very dutiful, serious story about how Captain Kangaroo wasn't a kangaroo court, as if people don't know that.
Okay, where are we at on Trey Gowdy? The reports that he was going to join the Trump legal team, that seemed to be on again, off again, on again. Where are we at on that?
It appears on again. My colleague Josh Dossie got senior administration officials to confirm last night that he is going to play some role as an outside lawyer, not on the White House payroll, and that he will be kind of one of the go-to Trump guys on television defending the president. And and so it's, you know, it's unclear, but I guess it's unclear who pays his salary, what you know, if he's there's some outstanding questions, but he was at the White House yesterday, and that does seem to be moving forward. And you know, I think we'll see a lot more of Trey Gowdy soon.
But Lordy, there are videotapes, and there are videotapes of Trey Gowdy making the passionate case for why the administration needed to cooperate with Congress, should not stonewall Congress. There are videotapes, which are rather striking, of a much younger Lindsey Graham making the same point. Is there any internal embarrassment at the contrast between then and now for these guys?
No. The short answer is no. I mean, and because there's also videotapes of Mike Pompeo.
Yeah.
I was watching some tapes of, because Pompeo, so Trey Gowdy ran the Benghazi committee.
Yes.
And, you know, and they were trying to get answers, and they demanded documents. Hillary Clinton testified for 11 hours in an open session. Mike Pompeo was on that same Benghazi committee that Trey Gowdy led. And there are dozens of quotes from Pompeo talking about how important it is. Frankly, even Donald Trump, we're used to it because, you know, there's a tweet for everything has become cliche. But Donald Trump attacked Barack Obama as a dictator and a tyrant and a king for doing things far less than what Trump is staking out. And so I just don't sense any kind of shame for the flip flopping, you know, like so much else with Trump. You know, it's situational.
No, everything is situational, and nobody has any memory whatsoever or any standard whatsoever. I want to talk about, obviously, the other big story of the day, and perhaps the bigger story of the day in terms of long-term implications, the Turks going ahead and invading Syria. What is interesting is that up until the moment that they launched this, that there were a lot of allies of the president who seemed to be holding out the possibility that Trump would change his mind, and that clearly did not happen. So I want to talk to you about that in just a moment. But first, here's a word from our sponsor. Okay, picture your face in the mirror. Do you see all those wrinkles around your eyes? How about the crow's feet or those large under-eye bags? Now imagine they're gone. I'm not talking about some risky, expensive surgery, just gone in minutes. It's called Plexiderm, a clinically studied serum that visibly eliminates your wrinkles, crow's feet, and under-eye bags in minutes. It's the edge you've been looking for. Plexiderm can give you the confidence you'll need to be yourself at work or out with friends. And the best part is, Plexiderm goes on clear so nobody will know you're using it unless you tell them. Go to tryplexiderm.com and use my code BULWARK for 50% off plus an additional $10 off. That's right, 50% off plus an additional $10 off. This offer is also available by calling 1-800-685-1292 and mentioning code word BULWARK. Plexiderm is backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. Visit tryplexiderm.com today and use code BULWARK at checkout. That's tryplexiderm.com. Okay, we're back with James Homan. Describe yourself as the editor of the Daily 202, the author of the editor of the Daily Daily 202, which I think is the must read, one of the must read newsletters in the morning. And of course, the lead story is the president's assertion of vast new powers and his declaration of war on impeachment. But the real war is going on in the Middle East. The betrayal of the Kurds seems to have genuinely shocked people who up until now seemed unshockable about Donald Trump. Even Franklin Graham was tweeting out, pray for the Christian Kurds and hope that President Trump changes his mind. Lindsey Graham, sort of desperately flailing out there, is tweeting to the Turks, "You did not get a green light," and yet they did get a green light, and they're invading.
Right, and they're in. We don't know how deep the incursion is yet, because they're Erdogan just announced, the Turkish president just announced a few hours ago that they're moving in, but they did get the green light on the call, and we know from our reporting, top people at the Pentagon were caught off guard by Trump's commitment to Erdogan in a Sunday phone call. And we also were hearing from the Pentagon, we obviously, besides the Christian Kurds, which is just shaping up to be an absolute tragedy of the highest order of historic magnitude, there's all these camps where ISIS people are being held, and the Kurds are going to have to defend themselves from the Turkish invasion. And so there's some concern that they're going to abandon these prison camps.
Thousands
of prisoners. And the Pentagon is saying publicly they don't have the capacity or a mandate to go, lock up these ISIS prisoners. There's no indication that the Turks have any kind of inclination or ability to take over these prison camps. So it's very scary stuff that could play out in really bad ways. And people at the State Department, people at the Pentagon are upset about it. Obviously, you mentioned Franklin Graham, Pat Robertson speaking out. One of the things Lindsey Graham did yesterday was he said if Turkey does this, there will be massive sanctions. And frankly, I find that hard to imagine happening. And I think one of the things is that there's just been such a blow to American credibility in the region that, what Trump said he was going to never let Turkey go into, this area a few months ago. The U.S. has gotten the Syrian Defense Force, the Syrian Democratic Force, our key allies against ISIS, to kind of scale back some of their defenses as a measure of goodwill because they promised that the U.S. would have their backs. So we've obviously throughout over the last 100 years, we've repeatedly let down the Kurds when they've been with us. But I just think it's one of those things where why would anyone believe anything? Our allies don't trust us and our enemies don't fear us when we say things and then we don't follow through. And that's been true repeatedly with Turkey. And I think that's going to be true again when you have all these U.S. senators saying we're going to sanction Turkey. Remember that the Turks just a few months ago bought all these missiles and other weapons from the Russians. They're our ostensible ally, and they faced no consequences from the U.S. government for doing so.
I see the comment from Michael Morrell, who's the former acting director of the CIA, deputy director, who said the Turkish military is about to move into Syria. They have. President Trump allowed this to happen, an ethnic cleansing of our Kurdish allies, a boost to ISIS, and a foreign policy gift to Russia, Iran, and China will be the result. America's standing in the world will take an immense hit. Okay, I just want to put that aside for a moment, because you and I know the power of pictures. We know Right. the power of video. If, in fact, there is ethnic cleansing, or if, in fact, there are horrific casualties among our Kurdish allies, those pictures are going to be a real indictment of the Trump administration. I mean,
yes.
there is a considerable downside to this more than most of the things that we talk about here. And there's got to be a lot of anxiety among Republicans thinking this can play out only in a negative way. There's no real upside. Leaving aside the damage to the brand of make America great again, and our position in the world, and the fact that nobody's ever going to trust us again. I mean, there's going to be a real human tragedy, and the responsibility for that tragedy is going to be pretty clear, isn't it?
It is. It will be. And obviously the president will try to deflect, but it is. You're right. There's not really there's a lot of less bad outcomes, but there's no good outcome here. for the United States and for the Kurds, and obviously the Christian Kurds important, but all the Kurds who have fought side by side and impressed our troops with their kind of ability and their great partners to kill Islamic terrorists who wanted destroy the United States.
This is one of those moments where I think that the president's instincts have really betrayed him, because he thinks that he of course, wants to frame this. He and his supporters want to frame this as the end to endless wars, which is actually a very powerful narrative. It helped get him elected. He is right about that. That does play very well. But I think that the way this story is playing out right now can be summed up in one word, which is betrayal. And that's not something that you that's not a great bumper sticker to be rolling into 2020 with.
Well, and you know, it's kind of amazing, because this has actually been one of the most successful U.S. military operations. We've had about 1,000 troops in Syria. You know, any casualties bad, but there've been essentially no casualties. This has been by any account an incredibly successful use of force compared to other recent, you know, American uses of force. And one of the great things about the 20th century was the 1940 election. Both the Republican and the Democratic candidates for president, Wendell Willkie and FDR, both believed in intervention. The popular thing to do was to be an isolationist. One of the kind of the troubling dynamics going into 2020 is both the Republican nominee for president and really whoever the Democratic nominee for president is likely to be are both running on this kind of easy narrative. It's an easy thing to say, let's end the endless wars. And none of the leading Democrats want, you know, American leadership in the world on these kinds of issues. And Trump also is saying that he doesn't. And so it is this kind of, it's the opposite. It's the inverse of 1940. And that does create a power vacuum. And as you noted, it's not as compelling visually, but it creates this power vacuum that a revanchist Russia and a rising China are all too ready and eager to fill.
There's a great book about the Wendell Willkie campaign called Dark Horse. Have you ever read it?
It's fantastic.
It is a great book, and it's an amazing story about the how important a losing candidate is in an election, because we live in this era now where if you lose a presidential race, you become, you know, you're cold product, you're a joke, you're irrelevant. And yet Wendell Willkie is still remembered for his principled run, even though he didn't win. It is a great story. Okay, let's go back. The Republican blowback against the Syria policy really is striking, because the language is very, very barbed. I mean, it is very strong. There's not a lot of, they're not furrowed brows. They're not concerned. They are, you know, all out critical of the president. And this comes from Republicans who would normally be absolutely reluctant, who have maintained their silence, who will not break with the president on Ukraine, will not break with the president on China. And of course, Lindsey Graham becomes the poster child for this, you know, that even while he is, you know, clearly deeply upset by this decision, he's still carrying water for the president, you know, by saying that, yes, I want to Rudy Giuliani come and testify in front of the Senate committee. So for anyone who thinks that this is the moment that Lindsey Graham remembers who he is and, you know, wakes up and realizes, oh, my God, what have I done? He's not going to break with President Trump. So give me your take on this dichotomy. Why Republicans who will never get crosswise with the president in any other context are willing to be so harshly critical on Syria?
I've been struggling with this, Charlie, and you might have a better idea than I do, because I actually do wonder that. And I think it's a very good question. Like, why is it okay for Trump to coerce the Ukrainians into investigating his political opponent, but not okay to kind of betray or, you know, abandon the Syrians? And perhaps it's because they think this is safer. You know, this is just speculation that they think it's, that if you cross Trump on the Ukraine stuff, that's fundamental to his, you know, that it's endangering his presidency. And if you criticize him on Syria, you know, that one, most voters unfortunately aren't paying close attention to the issue, but two, like it's not fundamental to his political identity or going to undermine his reelection. And so one of the things that has been interesting is Trump has not lashed out at Lindsey Graham and other Republicans who have criticized him on Syria.
And that, by the way, that is really quite a tell, right? So, mm-hmm. You know, Mitt Romney expresses concern about Ukraine and he gets a tweet storm. Lindsey Graham accuses the president of just about everything. I mean, lying, you know, betraying the country and all of this stuff, nothing. And I think this is the formula. And I talked to Tim Alberta about this yesterday on this podcast. And he said, look, you know, in Trump's mind, the Ukraine-China stuff or impeachment stuff, that's personal. That's existential. You know, that's about my job. And I will push back and hit back on you. But when it comes to an issue, even an issue as big as this, he doesn't care that much. That doesn't really affect him. So you basically have, you know, permission to break with him on an issue like this that you would never have when it would come to something involving his personal character, behavior, or the, you know, the oversight process in Congress, which is, again, quite a remarkable paradox.
It is. I think that I agree with Tim on that. I think that's right. It is what he takes personally. And you know, I think that he's less, it is kind of, I mean, I also think on a lot of these issues, because as we used the word situational earlier, like Trump really doesn't have core convictions on a lot of stuff. And so, you know, I think like that's, remember, we haven't mentioned this yet, but is it, cause we all know it, but last December, Trump announced he was pulling out of Syria and then backed down. After Jim Mattis and others resigned and Lindsey Graham and Marco Rubio and company criticized the move. And you know, one of the things in the 2016 campaign, people always wanted to be traveling with Trump because he's someone who often does whatever the last person he talks to before he makes a decision suggests. And I think that that's one of the things that happened here is that Trump was on the phone with Erdogan and Erdogan kind of appealed to his desire to end the endless wars, the easy narrative. And so Trump made a commitment and maybe in his head, Trump didn't think it was an ironclad commitment. Maybe Trump didn't believe he was giving a green light. But you know, then all of a sudden the Republicans are pushing back and maybe one of the reasons they're pushing back actually come to think of it is that, they do think that he would back off, to your question, you know, why are Republicans speaking up on Syria? Maybe because he backed off before.
Yeah.
They think this is something where we can actually move him rather than draw his ire.
Yeah, and apparently everybody then miscalculated here. So let's I'm going to dial back just for a moment to impeachment. There are these new polls coming out. In the Politico Morning Consult poll that shows that 50% of registered voters now say they would support the Senate's removal of Trump from office, that to 43%. So the latest poll to show it, you know, significant movement of public opinion towards impeachment, which seems to be something of a surprise to everybody who thought that there might be kind of a backlash. Republicans are still much more supportive of the president and or more skeptical of these polls. What is your read right now on where the public is on all of this? It seems to me to be easy to say that you're in favor of an inquiry, you know, and that what's happening is that his disapproval ratings and the impeachment numbers seem to be coming together. It seems much more radical, though, to say the president should be removed from office. And yet there's something going on now with public opinion.
Yeah. And the delta between impeach and remove. And I think a lot of Americans still don't really, you know, a lot of people who don't listen to this podcast don't know the difference between impeach and remove. And so, you know, to them, the way that the president talks about impeachment, you'd think it was removal. And so that, but our poll yesterday did show. And you're right. I think that the disapproved number is starting to track with the impeachment number. I think one of the reasons you've seen the shift is that Democrats who were kind of following the cues of Democratic elites and opposing impeachment now support it. And independents have moved, but so have Republicans. We did a national poll that was in the field through Sunday night, and our post poll showed, you know, about one in five Republicans, which isn't nothing, saying they're supportive of an inquiry. Again, most Republicans are with him. I think you don't want to overstate it. And there was a couple interesting things about it. There was a generational split, and the numbers were big enough that our pollster said, you know, it was legitimate and worth pointing out, which is, you know, Republicans, something like 40% of Republicans under the age of 45 are sort of open to an impeachment inquiry. And then among Republicans over the age of 65, it's like 13%. And so there is sort of that generational breakdown that I thought was really striking.
You know, that number was the eye-popping one, that you're talking about nearly 20% of Republicans supporting impeachment. And there's been some skepticism about that. I know Jonathan Swan was on one of the MSNBC shows saying he's not buying that because, you know, look, every other poll basically shows Trump's approval ratings near 90%.
Yeah.
And so how do you reconcile the two? And at this point, until we get a lot
more polling,
we just don't know. Okay, in the few minutes that we have left, though, I want to get your take on the week that the NBA has had going up against China. I find this story absolutely fascinating, particularly, you know, how woke the NBA has been and you know, and how it's wrapped itself in its willingness to be outspoken and how absolutely craven they looked in the face of Chinese pressure after one of their executives tweeted out just basically support for democracy in Hong Kong.
Yeah. Two sentences. I stand with Hong Kong. It's been embarrassing, you know, and you're right, because because of the rank hypocrisy of, you know, criticizing the NFL for not supporting their players and all that. I think that's one of the reasons it looked bad, but I also think, I mean, the NBA could not have handled this worse, and it did. Just the NBA obviously has a lot of money on the line in China. But the way that James Harden, who was the NBA's MVP last year, came out and, you know, said, we love everything about China. We love everything they stand for. We apologize. You know, the owner of the New Jersey Nets or the Brooklyn Nets said, you know, who also is a co-owner of Alibaba, basically attacking the Houston Rockets guy. It's really bad. I actually thought, you know, the positive glass half full part of the story was dozens of lawmakers in both parties, conservatives, liberals, put out statements criticizing the NBA and strongly for what they are doing in China. And it was sort of a reminder that there is still this sort of Washington consensus that we do support Hong Kong, we do support democracy. And I actually thought that said something about kind of some of the core principles and values, at least rhetorically, that still exist, you know, in this age of what feels like moral relativism all the time. And the NBA, Adam Silver, the commissioner, released sort of a walk back statement after the Sunday night apology on Tuesday morning. He basically, he was still trying to have it both ways, but he moved back. And I think what happened, it was initially the NBA was thinking of their money in China and their fans in China. And I think the pressure worked to get them to think about their fans in America. And I thought that was a good thing.
I think that is a good thing, too. But of course, I always look at the glass half empty, which is right. that, yes, there is this bipartisan consensus in favor of democracy in Hong Kong. But there was also a bipartisan consensus in favor of continuing to support our Kurdish allies. And we see how that's playing out. And of course, among the voices not raised in defense of Hong Kong would be the president, who reportedly in a private conversation with President Xi said that, he was going to stay quiet about that. You know, that he's not, you know, while they're negotiating the trade deal, he's not going to say anything about Hong Kong. So there's the moral relativism still has its as a foothold. And unfortunately, the foothold is in the Oval Office.
Yeah, no, and that's absolutely true. Trump keeps, even though advisors have told him not to, Trump keeps referring to the pro-democracy protests in Hong Kong as riots, which is what Xi does and what Chinese propaganda does. And that really, really grates a lot of people.
Well, James Holman, thanks for joining us again. I appreciate it. It is going to be a busy, it's going to be a busy week as we watch what's this tragedy unfolding in Syria. And as we watch the escalating war between two of the branches of the federal government. Thanks for coming on today.
My pleasure. Thanks, Charlie. Good to talk with you.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. Today's episode was brought to you by Plexaderm. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.